Okay, well, firstly, I'd like to thank the organisers. It's always a thrill to be invited to this mecca for theoretical physics. And I can tell... Oh, my talk's going on without me. Hold on a minute. I can already tell from the discussions in the room that I'm out of my depth. I work in a math department, so that's my excuse. So to hear astrophysicists and people who know about particle physics talking is inspiring. Feel free to ask me questions. If I don't know the answer, I'm going to put it to the floor. Let's try this again. Okay, so I've thrown a load of slides together, but I'm actually going to slightly change the order based on what I've seen already. And I'm going to start with a quote from Chandrasekhar. You get the feeling from this quote that this realization kind of hit him with a full force that out there in the universe were millions upon millions of this mathematical solution, first discovered by Roy Kerr. So in some ways, a black hole is like a happy marriage. Was it Tolstoy that said every happy marriage is the same, but every unhappy marriage is different in a different way? Okay, so our feeling has been that black holes are like happy marriages, all the same, differing only by their mass, their angular momentum, and in theory their charge, but we think that is negligible. There are many ways to try to visualize the Kerr black hole spacetime. Here's one possibility. I've taken a chop through the Sprungfield spacetime here. There is this zone where light rays can go around the black hole. So imagine kind of wrapping that around the axis. And you have a light ray here, which is going in the opposite direction to the rotation of the black hole. And one here, which is going in the same sense as the black hole. And those parts which are going in the same sense can be within the Erga region, which the previous speaker mentioned. It's this Erga region which is going to give rise to super radiance. Okay, so now I'm going to skip a fair bit. So let's start at 1973, when Bardeen, Carter and Hawking put together the four laws of black hole mechanics and observed that these laws were quite similar to the laws of thermodynamics. So the first law is that in a classical process, if the mass of the black hole changes and the area of the horizon changes and the angular momentum of the black hole changes, then they must change in this way. So there's a constraint. And the second law is that every change produces an increase in the area, an increase in the area of the black hole. So it's clear that this is in some way related to, well, it's analogous to the increase in entropy, and this is related to the conservation of energy. And Bardeen, Carter and Hawking noted this, so it can be seen that kappa over 8 pi, so here kappa is the surface gravity of the black hole, is analogous to temperature in the same way that area is analogous to entropy. But they were saying at this point, it should, however, be emphasized that neither of these, that these are distinct from the temperature and entropy of the black hole. Okay, well, that changed in 1976. Hawking and others looked at quantum field theories on classical backgrounds and realized that black holes radiate. And this gave a more precise way to associate a temperature and an entropy with a black hole and to get the prefactor right. And if you take this literally, then the entropy budget of the universe is dominated by black holes. And in the black hole mergers we now know about through gravitational wave events, these are supposedly generating huge amounts of entropy. For example, 10 to the 22 times the entropy of the sun was created in the first gravitational wave event. I'm sure at Perimeter, there are many interesting discussions about the microstates, black holes, and what this actually means. But that's not my theme. My theme is black hole superradiance. So we've already heard that black hole superradiance is an example of a Penrose process. So a Penrose process is a process in which the black hole increases its horizon area by releasing energy and angular momentum and possibly charge. So there are several Penrose processes, perhaps the most famous, is sending a particle into the Auger region. It's splitting apart, one part falling in, the other radiating, escaping with more energy than the initial particle had. In some ways, black hole superradiance is the wave version of that, but there are other processes which are also examples of Penrose processes. We're specifically interested in rotational superradiance, which is a stimulated or spontaneous radiation enhancement mechanism by which energy and angular momentum is extracted from a system. We've already heard about the spinning cylinder idea. I'll briefly note that in Nottingham, which is not so far from where I work, they have a big draining bathtub, a fluid tank experiment. There's a hole in the middle. They fill it with water. The water swirls around. And if they get everything just so, they can observe superradiance by sending in a wave of a fixed wavelength and measuring the modes, and in particular the dipole mode, and showing that the reflection coefficient is greater than one. So this has been seen now in a very nice experiment.
Do you know if they actually see the amplification or of the waves?
It's difficult by eye, but through extracting it, they can, yes.
Okay.
They have a plot with error bars on,
right.
And yeah. I've not put it in here. You can find it there. Okay, so rotating black hole can be stimulated to shed mass and angular momentum. And in particular, a perturbation will have a reflection coefficient greater than one if it satisfies this condition, where omega is the frequency of the wave, and capital omega is the rotational frequency of the horizon, and m is the azimuthal number. And so why does this happen? Well, it's a consequence of the second law. The second law of black hole mechanics says that the area must increase, and the first law says that there's this relationship. So if you put those together, kind of divide by dm, you get to here. So dA by dm is related to 1 minus the angular frequency of the horizon times dj by dm. When you think about a single mode, dj would be, I guess, proportional to omega m big omega. Okay. Well, since dA must be positive, the change of mass must depend on the sign of this term here. So I'm going to say that something is in the superradiant regime if omega multiplied onto omega minus m, capital omega, is less than zero. So let me give one example. And this is a very much an abstract kind of idea, because I'm going to think about perfect vacuum with no accretion disks or anything else. But imagine you sent in a wave toward a black hole. Most of it would be scattered, but some would be absorbed. And so you can calculate an absorption cross-section. And in the limit of a very short wavelength, that cross-section would just be the area on the wavefront defined by those rays which fell into the black hole. And the locus here would be those rays which flirted with the black hole indefinitely without falling in or escaping. But we can look at this quantity as a function of frequency. And the key parameter, just as before, is m omega, which is the horizon scale divided by the wavelength, essentially. What I'm going to show in a moment is that superradiance means that the absorption cross-section can turn negative. So here I have a plot for scale of waves, electromagnetic waves, and gravitational waves. And I'm specifically considering gamma zero, so sending this wave in along the axis. And then there are two possibilities for the polarization. We're thinking of circular polarizations. Either it's going in the same sense as the black hole, or in the opposite sense. And somehow the black hole doesn't want to absorb polarizations in the same sense, because that would spin it up. It doesn't want to be spun up because that would decrease its area. So it kind of wants to reject those waves. And we can see that in the absorption cross-section. and see down here at low frequencies that cross-section turns negative, and the effect is much more pronounced for gravitational waves in red than it is for electromagnetic waves.
For scalar waves, you're not plotting a region where the superabundance condition is satisfied. It looks like the black line is always...
Because these are plane waves.
It's because they're plane waves.
Oh,
so it's
not
the sum of all the modes.
M equals zero. So while... Thank you.
So because it's a plane wave, it's made of all the modes. Down here, the monopole is absorbed. Now, as you move up here, you've got these other modes in there as well, but they're not being amplified enough to make up for the absorption.
Okay.
That's what, 'cause I've added everything together. Yeah. Just another perspective. Okay. I'll skip that one. Okay, so we've already heard. We have this idea of super radiance, and it affects bosonic fields. This was a very nice plot presented in 2009. Of how this can turn into an instability. Okay, so if you have a mirror, as in the black hole bomb scenario, or a mass to the field, you can think of the mass as being a bit like a mirror at radius 1 over mass, Compton wavelength. Then you have a kind of a region where the field is trapped, then an angular momentum potential barrier, and then the kind of near horizon regime over here, from which you can extract the mass and angular momentum. So I want to take this picture and make it even simpler. Think of this toy model here. Okay, so I've got a system which is open on this side and closed on this side. And there are kind of two regions divided by a potential barrier, which I've put in here as a delta function, a certain height, well, infinite in height, you know, a certain integrated weight. So we have a traveling wave in this region and a standing wave in this region. In the case that the black hole is absorbing, the traveling wave is going off this way.
So I should think about the black hole horizon being way off over there.
Over here.
Like in tortoise coordinates.
Exactly, yeah. But this picture, this picture is useful for other kind of scenarios where you get similar kind of effects happening outside of black hole physics. But this will do for black holes as well. If we're in the superradiant regime, then the traveling wave is moving to the right, and so it's pumping up the field. Yeah. This is one way to think about it. And in fact, that's such a simple toy model that you can run through the analysis and find out that the spectrum has an imaginary part. Indeed, the imaginary part is frequency times by frequency tilde, which is this quantity we mentioned already. Okay, so that was the toy model. What I'm going to do now is present some results on instabilities for scalar fields, for the Dirac field, actually, where there is no instability, and then the Proker field, which has been the subject of lots of work recently. Okay, so let's start by thinking about a scalar field. So this could be the scalar field axion, for example. So the scalar field, satisfying an equation like so, with a mass mu. If we insist that the field is regular on the future horizon and dies away as you go off to spatial infinity, putting these boundary conditions on gives us a discrete spectrum of complex frequencies, because this is a non-Hermitian problem and it's open at the horizon side. So that's why we have an imaginary part here. And as we've heard, in the limit that this coupling, horizon size divided by Compton wavelength, is small, then we can think of this as being a bit like a hydrogen atom with a black hole as a nucleus. And the real part of the energy has a hydrogen atom spectrum leading order. And then you can work out fine structure corrections and even hyperfine structure to this. And in fact, this fine and hyperfine structure is in a paper by Baumann, Chia, and Porto. In fact, are you he? Yeah. Great. In April. So this is hot off the press. Well, I don't want to speak for you, but it looks like we have here a fine structure part which principally depends on the overtone number, but also involves some splitting now on L. And then we have the hyperfine structure, which is now linearly proportional to M, the azimuthal number. So all the different azimuthal modes are split as well. So you have a kind of rich possibility for transitions between levels.
Are there any challenges to computing this numerically to extremely high accuracy from the differential equations themselves?
Not really, no.
Just checking.
I'll mention the Dirac version of this, and in that case, we checked it using the numerical results, and in principle, we could have extracted higher coefficients numerically. But it's a typical problem of numerics. You can look at one mode easily, but can you look at all possible modes?
You know, I love analytic approximation. I was just curious if this is solved in that sense.
Spin one is harder, right? Spin one is different.
Yeah.
Spin one, the Broca field that he will talk about later, because it's not analytic, so it's slightly harder. But he will talk about it later. Yeah.
The problem here is the word hard is not defined. Everything is hard to me before the first coffee. So in the Schwarzschild case, we have this imaginary component to the spectrum, and it's always negative because all states are decaying into the horizon. It may be very small, because going back to our picture here, we have a very big barrier preventing much tunneling happening, but it's always going to be negative. But for the Kerr case, this changes to be positive if we're in the superagent regime. And we've heard that the dipole mode is the dominant one. And then we go to L equals 2 and so on. OK, so I'm going to show you, I'm going to talk a little bit about the bound state spectrum in terms of two dimensionless parameters. The first dimensionless parameter is just A, which is the spin ratio of the black hole going from 0 to 1, Schwarzschild extremal Kerr. And M mu here is what was previously being called alpha, I think, the gravitational fine structure, which is the horizon size divided by the Compton wavelength of the field. So for superradiance, we need, roughly speaking, the mass to be less than azimuthal number times by angular frequency. And the angular frequency is going to be less than this. So that means that the instability is only going to be significant for m mu of order unity, as we've heard before. It turned out to be exponentially suppressed, the large m mu. So when I thought about this, first in around 2007, following a paper that I'd read by Steve Detweiler, I was thinking that this was only significant for primordial black holes. I completely had not thought about very, very light fields, and I'm glad that others did. Okay, so I'm going to mention again the two key results. Zurus and Eardley showed that the imaginary part is exponentially suppressed when this coupling is large. So in other words, if the Compton wavelength is short compared to the horizon size, this is not a significant effect. It has to be something kind of coherent across the scale of the black hole to work efficiently. And then Steve Detweiler looked at the opposite limit, where the wavelength is very, very long, and the black hole is small in comparison. And this would be appropriate for something like the massive fields being thought about by, I've forgotten the names now. Very famous people, Ed Witten and some astrophysicists have been thinking about very, very light field. Anyway, so this is very strong scaling with the coupling. So really, all I and other people were doing around this time was just filling in the gaps between those two regimes. But the minimum e-folding time happens between those two regimes. For the scalar field, well, we had 100 seconds before, but I'm going to say here 29 seconds. multiplied by the ratio of the mass of the black hole to the solar mass. So put in 3 here, and we're back.
3.3. Numbers. Yeah, this is actually nice. I mean, this answers the previous questions about how it depends on the spin in a bit more detail than the spin of the black hole.
Yeah, so let me show a picture on that.
Okay.
So here is the dipole mode, co-rotating with the black hole. Here is the imaginary part of the frequency, which is like 1 over the time scale. And here is m times mu, our parameter. Here is the very, very strong power law growth of Detweiler, m mu to the power 9. Here is the cutoff. When the frequency is too big, we're outside of the superradiant regime. And on this logarithmic plot, well, what happens is this changes sign, this becomes negative again, and so that line goes off. Interestingly, we've got these different spin rates for the black hole, and they all seem to be roughly along the same line. Cutoff happens at a different point. It's not quite the case that the more the black hole is rotating, the higher is the peak. I've actually omitted the graph that shows that. When you get very close to 1, actually, there's a slight subtlety. Turns out this 0.997 is about the place where you get the maximum.
So there's a limit on black hole spin up from accretion, which is also like 0.997 or something in some Thorne paper. Is that related to that limit at all?
That's a very good question. I was unaware of that.
Okay. Yeah, I suppose I can't remember the paper straight off. But.
Yeah, that's Thorne and Price.
Yes,
and the limit comes from the fact that you have a disk which is emitting radiation as it tries to accrete onto the black hole, and it's actually the capture of the radiation which counter rotates with the black hole that sets a limit. Right. If you turned up the accretion rate, you turn up the emission of the disk, and you actually tend to continue to help spin down the black hole above this, quote, Thorne limit. It's model dependent, but it's this famous 0.998 number that gets thrown around a lot.
It'd be interesting if that was some...
I would assume this is related, and I'm surprised that's... Yeah, that would be... I'm surprised it's not known already. Yeah, that would be really interesting. You should be able to show that.
So this is just a numerical result at this point, and I don't actually really have a mechanism in mind for...
Interesting.
Yeah,
it'd be interesting
to see if
that
yeah,
works.
Yeah, we were looking at
I should have. That's the one plot I took out. I find it somewhere.
But it comes down to the black hole's cross-section, right? So maybe
there's no retrograde modes here to absorb. Mm. So it's the retrograde photons and the fact that the retrograde cross-section goes...
But I guess I have no idea why this is the limit. Why here? Why does it turn out?
You're still unstable at higher spins, it's just you're not as
unstable. You don't as unstable. Interesting.
Is it something you see as well, Will?
Huh? No, I haven't gone to the super high spins.
I mean, there's also an outside possibility it's a mistake. But let's not see that.
Very interesting to look at, and when you're in the extremal, you know, when you're in the rapidly rotating limit, you generally have the near extremal expansions available, which can often give you a little control all over again. So there may be a way of approaching this from the other side.
How does this change for spin 1? Did you do it? Did anyone check? Yeah, I guess this is what you were asking, Will. For spin 1, you didn't check, Will?
I think it could be done. It was going to be one point of my talk now that a team has separated the massive vector field equations.
If you go back to the next slide, I mean, I sort of have a global or forward. Yeah. I mean, this leads to like the global question about I think the whole program we're discussing here. So maybe this isn't the best time to tackle it, but it seems like there is a certain range of axion masses which one could in principle discover them or rule them out, and it's sort of given by about 3 orders of magnitude of black hole mass around stellar masses, and then 3 orders of black hole masses around supermassive black holes. And other than that, we don't have a continuous spectrum of black holes to probe. So
you can only have black holes.
What's that?
You can only have black holes.
We have black holes, don't we? But no, yeah, so I mean, that would be my question to you. So the point would be maybe you can use this to discover also kinds of black holes that aren't known, or are these particularly interesting ranges of axion masses for other reasons? Like, are they naturally pointed to by various...
Yeah, that's why Salas mentioned the QCD axion. So stellar mass black holes are pointed to because of the QCD axion. The models that you were describing from string theory, you have exponential dependence, so there it's much harder to pinpoint the prediction for the mass, but then you have astrophysical black holes in principle probe a 10 order of magnitude range. So it's not...
Wait, so it's certainly interesting to fill in the gap in between stellar mass and supermassive. If we can find things, it'd be very interesting to probe that range as well.
By the way, the other thing is, I mean, gravitational wave detectors would help with that, because, for example, LISA
won't have to
just rely on black holes that have strong accretion to see, and there's Avery will talk about our own black hole.
What about non-black holes? You mentioned why it's hard for neutron stars, but what about something like white dwarfs, where
even
you're
worse.
Not fairly boxed?
Yeah.
Even slower rotating, even less compact. And all those...
Less compact, so you'd be looking at lower mass actually.
Oh yeah, but which means that the rate, well... So, yeah, they're slower rotating, and basically you're absorbing less efficiently. And both of those things mean that the rate goes way, way down. It's a very high power law, as you can see from these things.
So the statement is, it's black holes or nothing.
And
we better go find some intermediate mass black holes.
That's good.
Vanilla particle candidates, yes.
The other thing is exactly the point, that black holes are very spherically symmetric. They're just, like, so perfect and simple. Axisymmetric, sorry. Yes. So astrophysical objects are not that perfect. So
but yeah, I mean, from here you can see if the spin is below 0.9, it's just 0.5, it's off the plot. So any astrophysical object, it's orders of magnitude slower.
This plot is just to show that the higher multiples give you lower, smaller imaginary parts and therefore much longer timescales. Well, it looks like there's one order of magnitude at least there going to the quadrupole.
So is the biggest plot for L equals 0?
No.
1 or is 1? So what happens when L equals 0?
But that would be spherically symmetric. Well, that would be the monopole. Little m, the azimuthal number, would be 0.
Right.
So there is no superradiant regime.
But one can imagine that if p-mode is excited in superradiant regime, then the particle transitions to the s-mode, and then it has a cross-section with a black hole to be absorbed back. Mm-hmm. Does that actually happen? What's the rate of it?
So that's very small actually, because the transition rate, if you had two particles and calculate the gravitational transition rate, is very long, so it's Bose enhanced, but turns out that rate is very small to transition from L equals 1 to L equals 0 and fall back into the black hole, so it doesn't do anything to the dynamics.
Well, it would limit the number of particles you can help.
Yeah, turns out it doesn't. I mean,
it doesn't actually
affect the dynamics for what is relevant there. For what we showed, what Savas showed before.
So it's a three-level system.
But that's why non-axisymmetric perturbations are very dangerous, because they may use large mixings between L equal 1 and L equal 0 level.
Well, except the point being that you can't actually with a tidal perturbation.
That might actually
be good, because suppose you have a perturbation that does that. Then you have a black hole that spins up, populates P1, and then you get transitions to L equals 0.
So why don't we meet back after lunch at around at around 2, at the time of the colloquium, and he can tell us all about exactly what you just said, because this is what they studied. So he can tell us, he can give us a brief. So let's continue.
A brief note on the profile of the bound states. Here is a tortoise coordinate, but this is measured. This is R over M, not here. So these modes can extend quite far outside the horizon.
And these will be L equals M equals 1.
These are all the dipole modes, the fundamental mode, the first overtone, and so on. This goes back to the uptick in frequency. As you decrease the mass of the black hole through this process, you also decrease this quantity here. And so you've reduced the fine structure constant, so you get modes which are further outside the black hole.
Sorry, what's the dashed line?
Oh, sorry, the dashed line is, the real and imaginary parts. Yes. I think.
Of the wave function.
Of the wave function.
Oh.
Yeah, so in particular on the left, you can see the wave traveling into the black hole.
Mm. And the solid lines are the absolute value. I think the point of taking the absolute value, one point was that where you have nodes, the nodes are not actually nodes anymore. They're not proper nodes.
Inca.
Yes. So in the hydrogen atom case, those would be exactly zero, but they're not a significant point. Okay, so this is my attempt to explain again how the black hole evolves under this process. So again, the picture is we start with essentially vacuum. There is some quantum fluctuation in the axion or whatever. And it bounces around like a laser, and the mode occupation number grows exponentially. And eventually that extracts significant mass and spin from the black hole. So here I've got on this scale m mu, and on this scale the spin of the black hole. And the picture here is basically that at this level it extracts much more spin than mass. So what happens is you start on one of these curves and you move to the right. Till eventually you come to a line which defines the cutoff for that mode. So here I'm focusing on the dipole, but there will be other curves for the quadrupole and so on. It's just another version of what we've already seen. So mu does not change, but the mass of the black hole does. It goes down, so that's why the lines are gently sloping down, and the spin of the black hole decreases.
So this is just Savas's plot rotated by 90 degrees. So if you flip it this way, it's what Savas was showing before. So, yeah.
The other detail is that the horizon area is always increasing in this process, going along the line direction.
Sorry, the area there is on the
wire? The area is on the wire.
Okay.
What is 1? Mu squared is 1 to pi.
Sorry?
No, it's the scale on the y-axis there, but okay.
Yes, a multiplying by the mass particle squared. Okay, well, that was the scalar field. I'm going to talk a bit about the Dirac field. It's a fermion. It has the Pauli exclusion principle, and it behaves very differently. But actually, I'm only going to talk about it at the kind of wave equation level. I'm not even going to go to a second quantized approach. And in fact, this is how I got started on thinking about this at all, and it goes back to Robert's father, who was my PhD supervisor. Now I've embarrassed everybody. So, yes. So we looked at the Dirac field around a black hole. And so this Lazenby is Anthony, 2005. And so I, as a PhD student, had to do a very boring calculation on the fine and hyperfine structure of the Dirac field. Well, actually, just the fine structure. I came out with this, which showed a splitting now between L, the orbital angular momentum, and J, the total angular momentum, beginning levels. And I made a mistake. And I only corrected it with my PhD student in 2000. and there is also this hyperfine structure as well, but I've not yet seen a successful calculation of the coefficient. We know it scales in this way, but we don't really know what that is. Okay, but the key point is for the Dirac field, all modes decay, there is no instability. So why is that? Well, here's a brief explanation. The Dirac current is made from the spinner directly without taking any derivatives. So you don't bring down the omega tilde in the exponent. Made like this. It's conserved. If you look at the radial component of the Dirac current, then because of nice separability properties on Kerr spacetime, you have the product of a radial term and an angular term. Okay, the angular term is positive definite. And these radial functions go like this for the field that is regular on the future horizon. Here, delta is proportional to r minus r plus. So this goes to zero as you approach the horizon. So you're left with just an R2 component. That's here. You pick up the minus sign. So JR is always negative, can't be positive. There's no derivative being taken here, so you can't pull down that omega tilde. So you might say, well, what happened to this law of black hole mechanics? You're violating it, because if the current is always ingoing, that means that you can absorb a co-rotating mode and spin the black hole up and reduce its area. Well, in fact, take this literally, you can do that. The reason being, the Dirac field violates the weak energy principle. So the weak energy principle asserts that the stress energy dotted with any time-like vector twice is always positive. The Dirac field violates that. And this was one of the key assumptions in the laws of mechanics. So that's why everything is consistent, at least. So I think to get a proper understanding of this, you'd need to think about the second quantized version.
There was a paper by Andy Strominger about fermion superradiance. Yes.
Did you see that paper?
Yeah. Do you understand what he's doing?
Yeah. Again,
No, I don't understand. No.
Okay.
I've had three children since I thought about this last basically. So, No, there's another paper. Yes, is it called the Kerr Fermi C? Is it that one?
I remember that.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
Because I thought that they were populated. I mean, no matter how, it would take many ages of the universe over to get that, but they were claiming that you could.
I don't think they're claiming any physical effects.
No, but somehow those levels stay populated.
Yeah. Well, that's the Dirac seed, right? You modify
the
Dirac seed in the principle.
But
no, these are negative energy states in the Dirac seed. The classical Dirac field has negative energy states. It violates various energy conditions, but in the vacuum they're filled. So.
No, but there's still hook and go variation, right? So you produce fermions at populated level, and there is some.
You end up with some stable state, you end up with not instability, you end up with
yeah.
Yeah, there's no stability,
yeah.
There's no exponential growth.
But
there's a fermions,
it's
a. But you know, it would be nice to understand exactly what's going on.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
But yeah, I don't think anyone's claimed any physical effects.
No, I don't think anyone can claim any physical effects.
But you can, okay, so I'm going to leave the Dirac field in a moment, but you can look at scalings of the decay rate, and they're going to fit into the pattern of the other fields.
And
one slightly interesting thing is that although you never get growth in the mode, around the superradiant frequency, you do kind of get these dips in the co-rotating mode, dips in the rate of decay. So here's the Schwarzschild line. And then the other lines are for a more rapidly rotating black hole. And this green line is for a co-rotating mode. And although it's still absorbed, it's absorbed at a much slower rate than the counter-rotating ones. This is just a numerical result.
Right, larger spin, does it get to zero exactly?
I remember we tried it with David Dempsey, my student, and he said no. And I said, try again. And then he said, I have to write up my thesis. And he now earns more than I did. So I think he made the right decision. OK, so I'm just going to leave the Dirac field there. But yeah, there might be something to be looked at, perhaps. OK, so now we come to the Proker field, massive vector boson field, I think what's described as the string photiverse possibility. And we expect fields with spin to undergo superradiance at a much faster rate. So this could be the dominant thing if such particles are out there. So here's what's known. So the Proker field is essentially the electromagnetic field with a mass term, one way to think about it. Because there's a mass term, instead of having two helicities, you have three polarizations. You can describe two of them as even parity and the other as odd parity under spatial inversion. And around 2011, Michelle Roser and I set out to try and look at the Kerr case, and we failed, and we wrote a paper instead on the Schwarzschild case, which is perfectly symmetric. But we did find some things which kind of carry through. We found that the odd parity part decoupled, and the even parity part satisfied a pair of coupled equations. Probably the most useful result was the decay rate, so that you always have decay in the Schwarzschild case, there is no superradiance. The decay rate scaled in this fashion, and it depends on this polarization. So we could see that if S was minus one, then you could get a kind of a much weaker power law here. So we interpreted that loosely as, in the Kerr case, faster growth. And then, it's all very well to speculate, but a lot of people have put in hard work to show that that is the case. Okay, so there's been a lot of work on this. Some work around 2012, 2013, and then a lot of work recently. Okay, so I'm just going to talk now about some very recent results by the organizers of this conference. I don't know this person, are they here?
May.
May. Hello. So I'm going to call you BLT. That's okay. BLT paper. And another team, maybe one person is in this room, David is here. So these are really important contributions to this. Okay, so the BLT found a similar scaling, well, the same scaling, but they'd also identified that we kind of incorrectly used the letter L. I think that's, so here J is the total angular momentum and L is the orbital angular momentum. So for the same L, J can be either L minus 1, L or L. That's related to my S. And Will East has obtained numerical data for the growth rate for the Proker field. And he'll, actually, you're not giving a talk, but Franz Pretorius is. Maybe there'll be some details of that. But this is one of the key figures. Here's the growth rate, so the imaginary part of the frequency. And here is m mu, fine structure constant. The dotted line, dashed line there, is the scalar field result, which I showed a while ago. The green line here is the growth of the Proker field. And you can see it's perhaps three orders of magnitude. Yeah. Three orders of magnitude faster. A nice concordance here between the numerical results shown in the black dots and the analytic approximation in the BLT thing. Okay, but then this year, there's a very nice result showing something that I find remarkable. The Proker field is separable on the Kerr spacetime. So this is the technical result. It's kind of... certain people will be, like me, will be excited by this, and it'll leave a lot of you cold. But the Proker field is separable, at least the even parity part is. It's weird that the even parity part is separable because we couldn't separate it even in the Schwarzschild case. Anyway, it shows it could do something substantial. Okay, so the ansatz is that the vector potential is related to the gradient of a scalar field with a tensor here. And after some very, very clever steps, we have a radial equation and an angular equation with a separation constant, which I've called here nu, which enters into these q factors and into sigma. Well, in the Schwarzschild limit, S must be the spherical harmonics. So that means that this combination terms must be L plus 1. So that's a starting point.
And, yeah. There's some hidden charge which explains the separability. Is that
Yeah.
Well, I have some slides, but I don't know if there's a taste for this.
What was the question?
Well, is there some hidden charge here which explains this separability? Is there some symmetry reason?
Well, everything is dependent on the Kinnikuman tensor. So, yeah, there is a hidden symmetry in
the case of time.
And it's called Kinnikuman tensor. It's two guys, you are not killing anybody. and it goes back, I don't know, to 70s by Penrose. But yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Well, I don't know if lunch is better than...
No, continue. You have another 10 minutes. Thanks to Savas, really late.
Answer the question.
So the Kerr space time is a lovely thing. It has these obvious symmetries. So it's axisymmetric and stationary. So it has two killing vectors, one going around and one dragging things forward in time. Those are the obvious symmetries. That means that geodesics have a conserved energy and a conserved angular momentum around the axis by dotting these killing vector fields with the tangent. But it also has hidden symmetries. Thanks to very, very nice papers recently, they're less hidden than they were. But this goes back to the 70s and Penrose and other people. And you can get everything by starting with a closed conformal Killing-Yano 2-form. So it's a 2-form, that means it's got a pair of indices and it's anti-symmetric in its indices. It's closed, meaning that you can write it as the exterior derivative of a vector. And it's conformal, meaning that when you take a derivative of it, you end up with the metric and some other vector. It's closely related to the time translation killing field. So its divergence gives you that. So I'm just going to wax lyrical a bit about this. So starting with that primary tensor, you build up a tower of symmetry objects, killing objects. So the Hodge dual of that Killing-Yano tensor is something that's usually called the Killing-Yano tensor, and I've called it F here. The derivative of that is totally anti-symmetric, so it's a free form. And again, it's related to the time translation killing vector. Now, if you contract F with itself, you get the killing tensor, which gives you the Carter constant. And you also get a conformal killing tensor by putting H together with itself. And they have these properties. And then finally, you get the azimuthal killing vector by putting killing tensor together with the primary killing vector. And remember, this was made from the divergence of H. So that's why it's called a tower, because you start with the base, which is the primary tensor, and you build everything else up from that. And it looks nice in four dimensions, and it looks incredible in higher dimensions. Very nice review. So why is this useful? Well, if you take a geodesic, you get conserved quantities. Two conserved quantities come from the killing vectors, but then you have this extra conserved quantity, the Carter constant, coming from the killing tensor dotted twice with the tangent vector. And that's why geodesics on Kerr are integrable, actually meaning that they're boring. So there's no chaos, there's no mixing. Yeah. But it makes it easier to solve. It also really helps with polarization. If you have a null geodesic, so a light ray, and you have a vector which is parallel propagated along that ray, so this could be the polarization vector. So if you have gravitational Faraday effect, you have parallel propagation along null geodesics. Then, if you make a complex number like this, from F and its dual, then this is constant along the ray. And that's the result going back to Penrose and Walker. What that means geometrically is this. Consider a scattering problem where you've got a Kerr black hole here. Let me send in some rays. What I'm going to do is construct a wave front around the central ray. So this central ray is pointing the middle of the black hole. Then I might think about another ray like this blue ray here, which is, so very far away from the black hole, it's orthogonal, it's parallel to the red line, so it cuts through this wave front at right angles. Comes in, it interacts with the black hole and scatters off. What do these constants mean geometrically? Well, the Carter constant means that this distance here is equal to this distance here. And the azimuthal conservation means that the y coordinates are related. So here, x points in the theta direction and y points in the azimuthal direction. Okay. But even better than that, so here I've taken those wave fronts, laid them out flat next to each other, before and after. If I were starting with some spin vector here, and dragging it along that ray, the conservation of Z tells me that if I draw a, so if I'm cutting the wave front at this point here, and I draw a line to the center, and then I think about the angle between that line and the vector, then that angle is conserved from before to after. And algebraically, you put it all together like this. So in one sense, these are abstract quantities, but in practice, they're very useful as well. And I think what I really like is that it feels like your group is on the verge of understanding another application of the Killing-Yano tensors. There's one further application I'm not going to go into, but if you want to take a ray and construct a null basis that's parallel transported along the ray, you can do that using F and H. You can construct Mark's tetrad, which is not parallel propagated, but it nearly is, and you can correct it to get completely parallel propagated null tetrad for the Kerr space term. So these symmetries are really useful. So somehow, these symmetries underpin the separability of field equations on the Kerr space time. So here I've tried to tabulate the different fields, scalar, spinner, electromagnetic, and now Proker and gravitational. In nearly every case, there's been a separation of variables achieved, but most of the breakthroughs happened in the 70s. So this is exciting for me because it seems to be the first tangible progress here since the 70s. Perhaps it's less physically relevant, but who knows, but it's a technical challenge that's been achieved and using some very nice symmetry properties. Do you want to comment on the odd parity case? I think that will follow shortly.
We have no comment on that.
But it's very nice because the even parity one is the one that is the fastest growing, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Physically that's...
So what I was told at some point by Sosposky is that the separability the integrability of the term makes it clear why the scalar field would separate, but it doesn't make it clear at all why the other fields would separate. Does your work now show a direct connection between the existence of Killing-Yano tensors and the separability of these wave equations?
Well, you can always construct like commuting operators. It's like playing on quantum mechanics. So if you can find a complete set of commuting operators, one of which is your field operator, then actually you can separate these things. So it's like finding a common eigenfunction of these commuting operators, and you can characterize this function by separation constants. and this function typically separates.
And the operator you construct is even in parity, which is why the separability is invalid?
That's a good question. I have no idea. but yeah, we have special ansatz for separability, and then we can show that this ansatz actually can be written in terms of these operators or whatever, but we don't know at all.
Here are the, in the case of the scalar field, here are those mutually commuting operators. They commute with box operator and also with each other, and they're built from killing vectors and the killing tensor. I imagine that, I'm not sure that these commuting operators are known in the gravitational case.
As far as I know, not. No. They are not really related to this killing element, sir. Yeah. As far as I know.
So there's still something to be discovered, definitely. Possible. All right, so let's go back to the Proker field in terms of the growth rate. Well, we're nearly there. So the separability that has been shown relies on a certain choice of ansatz. I've just copied this from the paper, but the ansatz is that this tensor here is the inverse of this tensor here. That's the metric. That's the separation constant, and this is the primary tensor. The technical details are in here. Okay, well, one reason why this talk is a little bit all over the place is on the plane, when I should have been writing the talk, I was trying to numerically solve things for myself. And late last night, I had a crisis point where I realized that there's probably still a bug left in my code. I can get something that looks just about right, but not quite. The good news is that you can just rip the graph straight out of someone else's paper. So this is the paper. This is the key figure shown in Roloff et al. From April, showing the growth rate for the Proker field. So the S equals minus one is the fastest growing mode. And there's a concordance here between numerical data, maybe from East, I don't know. That's the one. Others. And then the black dotted line is BLT. And the blue line is the data from these separated equations here. But the extra thing here is the S equals plus one mode, which is the slowest growing mode. And you can clearly see it's got a different scaling. Should. And that's not accessible through time domain simulations. Okay, I'm completely at sea about how long.
A couple minutes. Right, I'm just enjoying that I'm bacon, so.
I'm going to go off the topic here, but I guess you have a show called The Apprentice. You know, like The Apprentice. It's travelled over to the UK, and they had a kids' version of The Apprentice. So kids had to come up with innovative ways to make money. And so one group of kids had the idea to take bacon, lettuce, and tomato, but to make it cheaper and sell it for the same price by taking the bacon out. And they rebranded it as butter, lettuce, and tomato. Okay. Anyway, but if you ever get replaced in the collaboration, it will be with someone less cheaper to employ. Okay, so I'm going to use my final 2 minutes to just set the scene for looking at these instabilities in the time domain. We'll hear more about that from Franz Pretorius and others doing it much better. I'm going to skip all of that. Because of this non-separability, or presumed non-separability, people have gone on to look at the Proker field in the time domain. If you put a mirror in around the black hole, and you have this kind of bouncing around of the field, and typically when you look over time, you'll see the field, if you're at a fixed position, you'll see it oscillating. If you have a Schwarzschild black hole, then you have an open system, and the field drains away into the black hole. If it's rotating, then you can have growth. You can't really see growth there. You have this kind of thing. So many, many, many oscillations. The oscillations are happening on the kind of the mass time scale, but the secular change is happening over a longer time scale. I looked at this for the scalar field where the growth is slow, but other aspects are easier. What I'm plotting here is, so I set up some seed initial data. I evolve the equations in the time domain, and I measure some quantities. This is a bit confusing, there's too many oscillations, but what you can do is you can look at the energy in the exterior space-time and the angular momentum. So let's say you start with some pulse. It interacts with the black hole quite quickly, and some of it drains into the horizon, some of those non-superradiant modes. Then it settles down, and it looks a bit like it's stationary. But it's not. It's changing over longer time periods than 10 to the 4. This I call early time. At late time, so early time is here now. If you're prepared to wait long enough, 10 to the 6, you can begin to see this exponential growth occurring. But this is quite a challenge for the computer. There's a slight resolution dependence here, which you can see, but this is robust and seen by other people. If you do this for the Proker field, the growth is happening around 10 to the 3 times faster, so you reduce the burden. Once you have all the data, you can take a Fourier transform of it, try to get back the modes that are in the field. And you can take that data and compare the modes that come out of the Fourier transform with the spectrum that you calculated in the frequency domain. If you have it right, then they should line up nicely. So if you take some broadband initial data, it will tend to excite a bunch of modes, and you can see that.
So sorry, the modes that you're seeing there, these are just the regular Bohr? This is just the L equals mode, but different fine and hyperfine, or they're different
No, so this is M equals 1.
M equals 1, but different.
Different L and different N.
L and N, okay, thanks.
All right, well, I'll go on to my conclusion then. Conclusion is not really been written, but I'll read it out anyway. So I think that in the linearized regime, we have a good understanding of things, and that's got much better with the developments for the Proker field recently. Proker instability is much faster than the scalar instability. Perhaps some work has been done on S equals 2. I don't know if Richard,
only with these slow, small spin approximations. So.
But we would expect that to be faster still. We'll hear about that. Very nice new result from a technical level. Proker field separates. What I didn't have time for was that the question of, as this superradiant instability develops, what is the eventual outcome? And there are different possibilities that you might have axion annihilations, which we've heard about, or explosive phenomena called Bolt-Novas, or you might settle down into a hairy configuration which is quasi-stable. So there's been some nice work linking hairy black hole solutions found by Hederu and Radu with the outcome of a superradiant instability. And my final point is that using black hole surveys and gravitational wave detectors, we can search for ultralight bosons. It's a viable prospect, and becomes particularly attractive in an era where next generation particle accelerators might be very expensive.
Do you have more questions?
So, a question that I ask a lot, but I'm not sure if I've internalized the answer, is does superradiance of something like a Proker field, maybe superradiance associated with Alphane waves, which aren't a Proker field, but are at least a vector boson in some sense, related to Blanford-Nyack?
Sorry, what was the last one?
It is related to Blanford-Nyack, the formation of astrophysical jets by twisting up magnetic fields. Mm-hmm. Right, because I normally think of these jets as being Alphane waves, uh-huh. Right? They're driven by black hole spin, is there any relationship between these two things, or is that
so these Alphane waves are happening in a medium of plasma, or
Yeah, right. So there's a supporting disk that holds a field in there.
I don't know the answer. I think in the Banfords and Eichek mechanism, there's the electric fields are going all the way down to the horizon. It's their connection onto the horizon that's the important source for the energy. Things happening in the accretion disk only kind of go up to the ISCO, and from there on it's infall. So I guess I don't understand the dissipation mechanism well enough to give an answer. Because in the Blandfords and Eichek mechanism, it's the horizon itself that's doing the dissipation.
Well, I don't agree with that in a sense. I think they're analogous, perhaps not the same thing, but they're analogous in the sense that they need their origin. The horizon itself cannot be really the reason why there's the effect, right? Because the horizon itself is disconnected from the rest of the space there. So it must be just the frame dragging of the region that...
Well,
it's an absorber.
Careful.
It's an absorber.
Who said black holes also have jets?
There
is a connection.
But I don't think it must be... I mean, only the boundary conditions cannot just... In the sense that if I put a mirror and I have just a magnetic field in there that should, with an average, if I put a mirror in the horizon, for example, there should still be some kind of jet.
Yeah.
Perhaps the space-time will become unstable or something like that, but there will be a jet even if there's no horizon, but a mirror which is close to the horizon, right?
Right, but it's not the case that we need an ergosphere for a jet, because a massive black hole has no ergosphere and yet there is a jet.
But they're an effective ergosphere, right? Or an effective region where...
No, that's just...
No.
People are... It's not understood, but definitely it's not...
But I would think there's something analogous to the Rice and Ostrom, for example, where you have, in Rice and Ostrom, where you have super radiance, you don't have an ergosphere, but you can... Well, if you compute the potential of the...
No, but there's no. Unfortunately, it's still not understood, but definitely I wouldn't say that's the case.
Okay, guys. I think we're pretty hungry at this point. Thanks, Sam.